First, we recite the salutation to the Buddha. You repeat after me. Namo tassa.
Namo tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Sammasambuddhassa.
Sammasambuddhassa.
A second time. Namo tassa.
Namo
tassa. Bhagavato. Arahato.
Arahato.
Sammasambuddhassa.
Sammasambuddhassa.
A third time. Namo tassa.
Namo tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Sammasambuddhassa.
Sammasambuddhassa.
That means homage to the Blessed One, to the Worthy One, to the perfectly enlightened one. Okay, now we take the three refuges. I'll recite in Pali, and you recite also in Pali. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang sanghang saranang gacchami. Tutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami. Tutiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami. Tadiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami. Tadiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. My respect state. Sarana gamanang sampunang. Then you just say, right, amabut. Now we do the five precepts in English. I accept the training rule to abstain from the destruction of life. I accept the training rule to abstain from stealing. I accept the training rule to abstain from sexual misconduct. I accept the training rule to abstain from false speech. I accept the training rule to abstain from wine, liquor, and other intoxicants. I say, you have undertaken the three refuges and the five precepts. Observe them carefully.
Yes, Venerable Sir.
Okay, now we begin the talk. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, over the past several weeks, I've been speaking about sort of elaborating a statement of the Buddha found in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha says to the monks that they should develop wholesome states, kusala dhammas, and that these development of wholesome states lead to welfare and happiness. So then we raise the question, what are the wholesome states that should be developed? And I put these into three categories. One are the wholesome states included in meritorious actions. The second are the wholesome states which are constitute, we call the paramis or paramitas. And then the third are the wholesome states that constitute the bodhipakkhiya dhammas, the states that are the aids or requisites for enlightenment. And over the last couple of weeks, I explained the 10 bases of meritorious deeds. And what is significant, the significant sort of governing principle behind the performance of deeds of merit, is what we call the law of karmic retribution. This is the principle that the volitional actions that we perform have the capacity to bring results, to bring us results that correspond to the ethical nature of the original actions. So according to this law, unwholesome actions, immoral actions, evil actions, unwholesome karma, or evil actions, unwholesome deeds, brings the accumulation of unwholesome karma, a kind of energy which has the capacity or potential to ripen in the form of suffering and misery in the future. In other words, unwholesome actions generate undesirable fruits, undesirable consequences by way of causing lower rebirth, sickness, poverty, pain, and various types of suffering, either later in this life or in future lives. On the other hand, wholesome karma, virtuous actions, bodily, verbal, mental actions, generate wholesome karmic potential with the capacity to bring desirable fruits in the future, to bring a fortunate rebirth, to lead to rebirth into states of prosperity that will ensure success in one's undertakings, even bring physical beauty, intelligence, success in whatever one undertakes, good health, wealth, everything that people desire in the mundane way. Now, what lies behind the working of the law of karma is this principle that we call retribution. Good begets good results, bad deeds beget bad results. And the good karma, the karma that brings desirable results, this is called meritorious action. And the Buddhist texts give different lists of meritorious deeds. The most basic types of merits are generosity, moral discipline or virtue, and bhavana, meditative development. And then from these three root types of merit, there are different various secondary types of merit. But in order for the spiritual life to unfold in a meaningful way, it seems that it's not sufficient just to have this principle of retribution by means of which good actions bring good results, bad actions bring bad results. But it's also necessary to have what I would call a law of conservation in the spiritual domain. That is, a law by means of which good and bad actions also accumulate certain energies in the mind, energies which are preserved as the stream of consciousness flows on from one life to the next. That is, we need something to account for what I would call the cumulative energy, which is inherent in unwholesome and wholesome actions, or unwholesome and unwholesome qualities. So that when we habitually perform these actions, habitually generate these states of mind, they build up a strength, gather a momentum, which carries across through the entire duration of this present life and continues on into future lives. And I think within Buddhism, the idea of certain qualities called paramis or paramitas developed partly to provide, to meet this requirement. And what I found to be of interest and even curiosity to myself by studying the Nikayas, the Pali Nikayas, I found that they do not really give anything to account for this cumulative capacity of good and bad actions to continue on from life to life, this capacity for good and bad deeds to gather momentum and to carry through, continue through as persistent features of our character. It seems that in the Nikayas, presumably in the Agamas, almost all the focus, the attention is given to what we would call the retributive aspect of karma, how actions bring results that correspond to the nature, the ethical nature of those actions. But we need something to explain how the good and bad moral qualities that we develop build up an inner force from life to life, gain momentum across the succession of lifetimes, and then become integral aspects of our karma. We could call them even molding forces from one life to the next. And I believe that the doctrine of the paramis was introduced, at least in part, to fulfill this role. The idea of paramis, in quite the sense in which it's used in the later Buddhist tradition, doesn't occur in this sense in the old Nikayas, or presumably, as I say, in the Agamas. But they are introduced first in later texts of the Sutta Pitaka. In the Pali canon, they come in the work called the Buddha Vangsa, a work which gives an account of the lineage of the past 24 Buddhas and how the future Buddha Shakyamuni, as a bodhisattva, made his original aspiration for enlightenment under the Buddha Dipankara, received the prediction to Buddhahood from Dipankara, and then practiced under successive Buddhas until he became the fully enlightened one. In the northern Buddhist tradition, I think the paramis or paramitas might have been introduced in the Sarvastivada text, the Avadanas. And they were later then incorporated wholesale into the Mahayana doctrine of the Bodhisattva path. But the doctrine of the paramitas or paramis seems to have been what I would call part of the pre-Mahayana soil out of which Mahayana Buddhism arose. And so, though many books on Mahayana speak of the paramitas as something special to the Mahayana, but actually the idea of paramis or paramitas are common to the two traditions. They might be considered even forming a kind of bridge which connects early Buddhism in its later phases to the early Mahayana. We have two words which basically convey the same idea. In Pali, the Pali tradition, the word most commonly used is parami. Though sometimes, occasionally, the word paramita is also used. In the northern Buddhist tradition, the more common form is paramita. Both words are simply abstract nouns coming from the adjective parama, which means supreme or excellent. And so a parami is a, you could say, a supreme quality, excellent quality, or you could say perfection. But some writers like to see the word paramita as coming, you could take the word parang and then join to it ita. Ita is a past participle, which means gone, and parang means the far shore, the other shore of a river. So they explain paramita as meaning something which has gone to the far shore. This is, we say, a playful explanation. But the real literal derivation is from the adjective parama, supreme. And originally, in the Buddhist text, the idea of paramis were introduced to explain the practices which a bodhisattva undertakes in striving for the attainment of supreme Buddhahood. This is how the idea is first introduced in the Buddha Vangsa. We see the future Buddha Shakyamuni living many, many aeons ago, incalculable aeons ago. And at that time he was an ascetic by the name of Sumedha. And he had come from a very wealthy family. Both his parents had died when he was a young man. And after their death, he inherited a large, a vast estate. But then he reflected that all wealth is transitory, that life ends in death, and that there's nothing belonging to us in this world that we can take with us when we die. And so he made the decision to leave the household life, to give up his mansions and stores and hoards of gold and silver and precious gems, and he adopted the life of an ascetic, going to live in a cave or kuti, cottage in the mountain, hut in the mountain. And he practiced meditation, and very quickly he achieved all of the samadhis, or deep stages of concentration, attained various spiritual powers. And then one day when he was going down to the village on alms round, he heard the news that the Buddha named Dipankara had appeared in the world, and that Dipankara was going to be visiting the city nearby the mountain where he was living. And so the ascetic Sumedha, he was overjoyed by this word, by this news that a Buddha had arisen in the world. And so he went to visit the city where the Buddha was expected to arrive, and he saw the people working, preparing the road for the Buddha to enter the city. And at that time, the road was partly muddy. There must have been a heavy rainstorm a few days earlier. And so they were cleaning up the mud and making the road, strewing it with sand so the Buddha would not get his feet dirty as he entered the city. And just as Sumedha, the ascetic Sumedha, was working on his part of the road, then the Buddha Dipankara arrived at the head of a large number, a great assembly of monks. And they came walking into the towards the city. And when the ascetic Sumedha saw the Buddha approaching, then he was so overawed by the presence of the Buddha that he bowed down in front of him, right in the mud, and spread his body on the ground and offered his body as a plank for the Buddha and the monks to walk across. But when the Buddha came in front of Sumedha, then there arose in Sumedha's mind the wish, the aspiration, let me not listen to the teachings of the Buddha now, the teachings intended to lead to deliverance, to nirvana, but let me make the aspiration, the wish, in future aeons, in future time, to become a Buddha. And so then when the Buddha came just in front of Sumedha, he looked down at him, saw this ascetic with his long hair, beard, scraggly rag clothes, lying down, covering the mud, forming a plank for him to walk over. And he stopped and he looked at that ascetic, and then using his own mind, he looked deep into the mind of that ascetic, and he saw that this ascetic has just made in his mind an aspiration to attain Buddhahood in the future. Then he asked himself, will this aspiration succeed? And when that question came into his mind, then he could see at once that this ascetic will, after so many thousands and thousands of kalpas, of aeons, that he will become a Buddha named Gautama or Shakyamuni, living in such and such a part of India with such and such disciples. And so then he gave the ascetic Sumedha the prediction, or it's sometimes called the prophecy, of his future attainment of Buddhahood. And then instead of walking over him, the Buddha walked around him and also told the other monks to walk around him. Then after Sumedha had received this prediction from the Buddha, then he sat and he reflected, if I am to attain Buddhahood, then what are the qualities that I have to perfect in order to attain it? And as he reflected in this way, then these 10 qualities, called the 10 paramis, came to his mind one after another. Okay, so this is how the idea of paramis originally entered into, at least in the southern Buddhist tradition, the Theravada tradition. But as time went on, the idea of paramis or paramitas was given an extended interpretation, so that they become not simply the qualities, or not exclusively the qualities that a bodhisattva aiming at supreme Buddhahood has to fulfill, but they become the qualities that any aspirant for enlightenment in any mode, whether as disciple, that is an individual, as a direct disciple of the Buddha, or as a Pratyeka Buddha, a privately enlightened one, or as a Sammasambuddha, a perfectly enlightened one, has to fulfill. So generally, we speak about people as being engaged in the development of the paramis that correspond to their spiritual aspiration. And the Pali commentaries, they grade the extent to which the paramis have to be developed according to the aspiration of the disciple, of the follower. They say that in order to achieve supreme Buddhahood, one has to perfect the paramis for something like 16, at the maximum 16 incalculable periods, plus 100,000 great aeons. Then for bodhisattvas of somewhat sharper faculties, it goes down to 8 incalculable periods. Then for those of the sharpest faculties, 4 incalculable periods, plus 100,000 great aeons. And how long a time does this actually amount to? 1 great aeon is the time that it takes for a world system to begin from the seed or nucleus form, then to evolve to the maximum point of expansion, expanding from the nucleus seed form, a world system starts to expand, to unfold, to develop, till it reaches a point of maximum expansion, then it starts to contract, to withdraw till it reaches the point of maximum compression. So this is really like one big bang plus one big crunch. That is the duration of one world system. And according to modern science, our present universe is something like 15 billion to 17 billion years old, and it's still expanding. So suppose it goes on another 17 billion to expand. Suppose it contracts 34, 68 billion years to go through the complete cycle of expansion and contraction. Then one has 100,000 of those, that makes 100,000 great aeons. But the number of great aeons, that's only like change, small change added on to the number of incalculables. So 4, 8, or 16 incalculables, those are durations of time utterly inconceivable to the mind. And so those who aim for supreme enlightenment as a Buddha have to perfect the paramis over that period of time. Those who aim to become Pratyeka Buddha have to practice for 2 incalculables and 100,000 great aeons. Those who aim to become great disciples of the Buddha, they practice for 1 incalculable and 100,000 great aeons, and so on downwards in diminishing lengths of time. Okay, now in the 2 Buddhist traditions, the southern tradition, we have 10 qualities which are called paramis, or sometimes paramitas. In the northern tradition, absorbed into Mahayana, we have originally 6 paramitas. But the 6 paramitas in the northern tradition later get elaborated into 10 paramitas, which are somewhat different from the set of 10 in the southern tradition. But the 2 sets overlap to a great extent and are in no way mutually exclusive, but rather qualities which are designated by one expression in one tradition are designated by a different expression in the other tradition. Okay, so I will explain now the 10 paramis in a general way, but according to the way they're explained within the Theravada commentaries, they're explained with reference to the practice of a bodhisattva aiming at supreme Buddhahood. And so the commentaries define the paramitas, or paramis, as noble qualities beginning with giving, accompanied by compassion and skillful means, and untainted by craving, conceit, and wrong views. That is, these qualities, such as giving, moral conduct, and so on, somewhat different from the practice of meritorious deeds, even though the names of the qualities are the same, but the mode in which they are practiced differs. In the case of meritorious deeds, it doesn't really matter very much what the motivation behind the action is. If the motive is a benevolent one, so much the better. But if the motive is an altruistic one, so much the better. But if one practices them just to gain merit so that one wants to ensure a happy rebirth for oneself in the future, the quality of the merit still remains intact. The deed is still a meritorious deed, though it's somewhat blemished by a self-seeking or egocentric motivation. But in the case of the paramis, they only become spiritual perfections when they are accompanied by compassion and by skillful means. And to be accompanied by compassion means that they are rooted in compassion, which is the great aspiration of the bodhisattva. That is, the great bodhisattva makes the aspiration for Buddhahood out of compassion for the world, in order to find the way to deliverance to liberation from suffering for all the world. And what motivates him in making that aspiration is great compassion, mahakaruna. And this great compassion underlies his practice of the paramis from beginning to end, and it accompanies the performance of the paramis. And then the practice of the paramis is said to be accompanied by skillful means. And by skillful means here is meant the wisdom that transforms these practices into supports for supreme enlightenment. And skillful means also signifies the ability to find opportunities for the practice of the paramis and to be able to practice them in the way which brings the greatest benefit to other beings. For example, a very obvious example in practicing skillful means, a bodhisattva, if somebody comes to him and says, please give me a gun so that I can rob a bank, the bodhisattva, though he wants to practice giving, is not going to offer him a gun. Okay, and now on the sheet of paper that I handed out, I had written up a sort of classical formulation of the aspirations by which bodhisattvas practice each of the paramis. And now I will go through them individually and explain the practice of the paramis based on these formulas. Does everybody have the sheet? Okay, first is the perfection of giving, or dana parami. And this takes the form of the aspiration, or it's motivated by the aspiration, may I always be generous and open-handed, giving to others the threefold gift in accordance with their needs, joyfully, with a heart free from the taint of selfishness, with a heart overflowing with kindness and compassion. Here this formula shows, first of all, the attitude which is to be taken when one takes up the practice, when one engages in the practice of giving. That is, the attitude has to be one of a generous heart. It's not merely one of being generous externally in what are the objects that one gives to others, but the attitude has to be one of free-flowing generosity, generosity which does not have any reservations, in which the mind is not holding back on its possessions. It's not a generosity in which one is mentally dividing up what belongs to you, what you will keep for yourself, and what you will donate to others. But rather it should be rooted in the kind of idea that whatever one has that can be utilized by others should be, at least in principle, used for the purposes, for the purpose of benefiting others. And so one just ideally, one is aiming to reach a perspective where one doesn't make claims on any of one's possessions, but one just sees whatever one possesses as means for helping and benefiting others. And then what one gives to others are the threefold, what's called the threefold gifts. This is refers to a traditional classification of generosity in terms of three types of things that one might give. The first are material things or possessions. And these might be either material possessions, external things that one possesses, giving wealth, giving food, shelter, clothing, medicines, giving instruments, devices that might be needed. For example, if you learn a certain organization needs, say, a new computer, new printing press for publishing Buddhist literature, you help to make that donation. If you hear that some organization is collecting funds for distributing medicines to the poor, you give to assist the poor. So you try to give material things of any kind in any way, as long as those things will truly be beneficial to other beings and are not to be used in any way that will harm them. But also in giving material things, one also has to apply a certain degree of prudence, and one should not try to push, though ideally one has the attitude of giving everything for the benefit of others, but in practical terms one still has to function within the world, and so one has to recognize that there are limits to the amount that one could practice giving right here and now, that the practice of giving, it's a skill that one has to develop and cultivate over time. And so one should not give in such a way that one creates extremely burdensome hardships for oneself. But apart from that, one should give to the utmost of one's capacity. And the important thing is not so much the amount that one gives, but the attitude of wishing to be free from objects of attachment and wishing to help and to benefit others. Okay, so these are first material things in the form of possessions or external objects, and then material things relating to one's own body. That is, at the highest level, the bodhisattva is ready even to sacrifice his own life for the good of others. And in the Jataka stories and other stories of the Buddha's previous lives, there are many accounts of how he gave his life for the welfare of others. But at this point, we're not able to make such a momentous sacrifice, but we can give from our own body in ways that might be accessible to us. For example, if one is strong and healthy, one can donate blood to the blood banks without expecting anything in return. Or some people who are very courageous offer one of their kidneys. In fact, it's quite common in Sri Lanka. Well, I wouldn't say common, but I've heard of at least 4 or 5 cases in Sri Lanka of Buddhist monks. These are so-called Hinayana monks who are supposed to be, according to some Mahayana texts, selfish and self-seeking, who without any expectations gave one of their kidneys just for the purpose of fulfilling the practice of generosity, of giving. And I think of all countries in the world, Sri Lanka is the leader per capita of people who offer at their deaths their corneas to be given to others. And there's an eye bank in society in Sri Lanka, in eye bank society, where we could fill out a form to make a gift of one's corneas upon one's death. And there's always been a big, large list of people who have signed up to donate their corneas. And the reason why this idea is has had such an impact on Sri Lanka is because it stems from emulating the Bodhisattva's example in the Jataka stories. And so one can offer, even if one can't offer parts of one's body while one is alive, but one can offer, for example, the corneas of the eyes or certain vital organs to be used either for transplants or for medical research. And this will be a great source of merit and a great way of fulfilling the practice of dana parami, the perfection of giving. Okay, so this first, material gifts, either external objects or one's own body. Second is the gift of fearlessness. This means giving a sense of safety and security to other beings, particularly when one meets with people who are afraid, anxious, worried. Then one tries to console them, to dispel their fear, to give them courage, to inspire their self-confidence. Or if they are in true physical danger, for example, if their life is threatened in some way, then one should try to protect them and safeguard them. For example, if this is something that I've encountered in Sri Lanka, there have been very tumultuous periods in the recent history of that country, and there was a period when some of the mobs, I have to say, of Sri Lanka, of Sinhalese people, had risen up against Tamil people and were burning their homes and attacking them physically. And the Tamil people, when they had to flee from these mobs, many of them ran to the Buddhist temples, which were occupied by Sinhalese monks, and because they felt that in the Buddhist temples they would be safe and secure. And the Sinhalese monks protected Tamil people, even though it was mobs of Sinhalese gangsters and thugs who were attacking them. And so one tries to offer protection, safety, security to human beings who are under attack, and also to preserve life, we also try to protect the lives of animals who are in danger. And so it's a common practice in Buddhist countries to buy animals which are slated for slaughter and then to release them. For example, again, I have to appeal to Sri Lanka, where I've lived for so many years. It's a common practice for Buddhists to form societies in which they collect funds to buy cattle that have been destined for slaughter. They buy them from the slaughterhouse. Then after they purchase the cattle from the slaughterhouse, then they give them to farmers to use to extract their milk. They give them to dairy farms. Okay, so the second type of gift is the gift of fearlessness, which could be either psychological security or physical safety. And the third type of gift is the gift of the Dharma, of the teaching. This is because the Dharma, or the doctrine of the Buddha, the teaching, this is considered the foremost of all gifts, because all other gifts will only help to alleviate pain and suffering temporarily. And all other gifts will only bring a temporary type of benefit. But it's the Dhamma which has the capacity to eradicate all suffering permanently and to bring the highest happiness, bliss, and peace. Okay, so this is the threefold gift. One gives to others the threefold gift in accordance with their needs. That phrase indicates that one has to give what is truly needed by people. One doesn't give gifts arbitrarily just for the purpose of practicing generosity. But to really practice generosity skillfully, one has to understand what different types of people, different types of beings actually need, and one has to give the type of gifts that are appropriate for each one. And then the text goes on to say that one gives joyfully. This indicates that when one practices giving, one has to arouse a mind of joy, not just give the gift casually, as though you're trying to get rid of something that you don't really want, or as though you're, some people give, they do it almost as though they are despising the recipient. Or they, when they give, they still have some clinging to the object to which they're giving, to the object they are giving away. But when one gives, one should arouse joy. It said joy before the act, because one prepares one's mind with the thought, now I have this opportunity to practice generosity. This is an occasion which will enable me to strengthen and bring to fulfillment my practice of the Dana Paramita, the perfection of generosity. So beforehand one arouses joy, and during the act one experiences joy and happiness, so that in the very act of giving, as the object passes from your hands to the hands of the recipient, then your joy increases, and when it leaves your hand, then you feel so happy, because you've gotten rid of one object, of one potential object of attachment. And then after the act of giving, then you review this act of giving, not reviewing it with attachment, but one reviews it thinking, how good that I have practiced this generosity. And then one feels joy and happiness after the act. And so then one gives in this way, by arousing joy, then one is giving with a heart free from the taint of selfishness. Selfishness is compared to a taint on the heart, just like we have rust as a taint of metal, oil is a taint on clothing. So selfishness or stinginess is a taint on the heart. And to practice generosity with joy helps wipe off that taint of selfishness from the heart. And in the act of giving throughout, beginning, middle, and end, one is doing so with a heart overflowing with kindness and compassion. Even at the beginning, one might not be able to arouse that kindness and compassion when giving, but if one practices giving and arouses joy, then little by little that joy will break down the barriers of discrimination between self and others, and then one will be able to experience a flow, a warm flow of metta and karuna, loving kindness and compassion, in the very act of giving. Okay, maybe I think I've gone over my time limit. So we will continue with discussion of the paramis next week. Thank you all for listening, and may the blessings of the Triple Gem, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, be with you all. Now we share the merit with the devas and other beings. Etavata ca mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.